what kind of habitat the chickens could be in.
Right. And prohibiting people from seeing the chicken coops. So if you let a reporter into your chicken coop, you lose your contract. And the amount of debt chicken farmers are in. They're making like $18,000, but they're in debt $400,000, you know. So those of you with business backgrounds, really, there's a lot of really good business angles to this. The corn story is important. It's about how much corn is in our food and how much food is a rearrangement of corn. You get the Jack-in-the-Box E. coli story, a very touching segment from a mom who lost her kid in the early 90s because of that, and a conservative woman who's trying to get Kevin's Law passed. Kevin's Law was a, let's see, what was it going to be? It was a food, I think it was a food safety and inspection law? I don't know, let's look it up. I'm blanking out on that. And then you get the Joel Salatin show. He's the character with the. Does anybody want to tell the rest of the class? Remember, Joel Salatin was the farmer with the cowboy hat, and he had some views about food integrity. Does anybody remember those? Yeah. Okay. What I liked about his message was that he really thought there was something like honest food. And dishonest food is food that in which the producer is imposing costs on the society that are not incorporated in the price of the food. So I think that's a really interesting conceptual distinction. You see? So, but he also has this idea that, and this is a good one for business students, that honest food is threatened when you try to maximize production. So he thinks the food industry, if it's going to produce honest food, he's a farmer, he produces animals and crops. But he said, I can't do this at this quality level if I scale up industrially. So the claim, which is an interesting claim from a business perspective, is can food be the kind of business where investors expect growth every year? And that's a really interesting problem, right? Because if you expect growth in the food industry every year, we've got to keep eating more. And that's kind of what we're doing, right? So I think that's I think he put his finger on a connection between integrity in food and honest food and a significant problem in a capitalist society, not to object to capitalism in general, but in the food industry, it's a problem. And it's similar to the problem in the medical industry, right? So there was a hog segment. Did any of you know that you could actually process 32,000 hogs a day? That's just a staggering figure. Food Inc. has some of the most grisly imagery, right? Am I right? You've got the plant that produces the stuff that you mix with hamburgers so that the E. coli that you're eating in hamburgers won't kill you, right? That came about after the Jack in the Box scandal. So you get this incredible industrial picture of an industrial system, highly, you know, pretty impressive actually, and it produces this ammonia kind of substance that they mix with hamburgers so that because there is a lot of shit in the hamburgers. This will kill the germs so that when you eat it, you're still eating shit, but it won't kill you. So that was an exciting segment. There's a nice segment on the organic industry. I thought it was fun because you get this footage of these people when they were hippies, and then they're selling to Walmart, and there's this kind of question about whether that's okay or not. You know, is that a sellout? And there is an issue about what organic is. A lot of foods get labeled organic, but that might mean that, you know, you can grow carrots in sand in Mexico and call that organic. The carrots will not have the nutrition or sugar that you associate with a really good carrot. But it's organic. So there are pseudo-organics, there are, you know, industrial organics. We're going to have to learn more about that. I think that's kind of interesting stuff to learn. Could somebody from this movie group explain the Monsanto seed patent issue and who the seed cleaner was and what happened to him? Do you remember that one? Give it a shot. Oh, sorry. I'm always looking at the wrong group.
I don't remember who the seed cleaner was necessarily, but the patent issue is that companies like Monsanto are genetically modifying corn seeds or soybean seeds and then distributing those to farmers. And then when their crop grows and inevitably produces more seeds, they're not allowed to collect those seeds and replant them.
Right. And that's legal. I mean, the Supreme Court said you could patent life, you could patent seeds, and so that was a little controversial at the time, but so now you can't clean your own seeds. If you don't use Monsanto seeds, you may still, and you're in a business, seed cleaning is a business. You go and you take a portion of a farmer's crop and you clean the seeds, you separate the seeds from the debris. And so there's a seed cleaner in there who's being sued by Monsanto. You also learn, I think, in this movie about the Oprah case. Is this in this movie, too?
Yeah.
Because Oprah was sued because under veggie libel laws, she had a guest on her show who said disparaging things about beef. She then spent, I think, $1 million to extricate herself from this, but she has a lot of money. But the seed cleaner was bankrupted. And so there's some really powerful stories about the law and food libel laws and things like that. Okay, any last-minute things to add from this group? Good job. Thanks. Yeah, okay. So let's take a look at Fed Up. Okay, so Fed Up's you guys. Nice big group here. So this is really focused on sugar. And could you guys produce a couple of the details from the learning on sugar, the teaching on sugar in this movie? Is there something about it that you would, maybe it might even be something, one of the facts I picked out was that of the 600,000 food products we produce in this country, 80% have added sugar. Why is sugar a problem? Could you guys help us understand what they were saying in the movie about what processed sugar does, how in your digestion, how it goes? Yeah. Evan, start us, and then you can.
Refined sugar, not in fruit,
right,
doesn't have any fiber associated with it. So when you ingest something that has added sugar, the sugar goes straight into your liver and uses insulin, and it just turns it into fat immediately because it's just getting absorbed just as refined sugar instead of slowly being released into your system if you have fiber along with it.
Right. Good. Did you want to add anything to that? Good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
I can add something.
Please.
And not only like does it add fat, but it doesn't fill you up, so you're still
right. It blocks. I need to see documentation on this, but it blocks the claim was that it blocks the signal
that insulin blocks
to tell you that you're full. And remember, we talked about satisfaction being one of the pillars of the philosophy of food. If you're not satisfied by your diet, so the insidious thesis would be that the food industry doesn't want you to be satisfied. Not that they consciously think, haha, this is what we want to do to people, but they want to make more money for their investors. Fair enough. So they want to sell you products that will keep you eating, and that's what products that have highly refined sugar, salt, or fat do. Okay, good. I was sad about the Obama campaign that got co-opted by the industry. Fundamentally, the argument in this movie was that the Department of Agriculture has a conflict of interest because they're promoting production, and yet they're also supposed to be promoting good ideas. The Great Cheese Story. I labeled some of these as stories because you're going to hear these stories in more detail and from more authoritative sources as the course unfolds. But the cheese story, does anybody from this group remember what the cheese thing was about? When we went on low-fat diets, producers took a lot of fat out of the milk.
They took the fat out of the milk and then they turned the fat into cheeses.
Right. 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 So the fat got taken out of one food, substituted with sugar, and then we promoted high fat cheese foods alongside that. So the school lunch story is another story you'll hear more about. After the decline of federal funding for the school lunch program, most schools made contracts with fast food providers. Pizza became a vegetable. It's amazing. This is ideology when you fool yourself in this way, right, at the societal level. One thing I learned in this movie that I didn't know before was the acronym TOFI. Could you guys tell, this is people who, you can be obese without being huge. You can be obese because your body is storing fats in organs in ways that are harmful and can lead to disease. So you can be, a TOFI is thin on the outside, fat on the inside. Kind of interesting. Yeah. Okay, so a couple of movies have this kind of tobacco food industry analogy. So does the cigarette of the 21st century is kind of the slogan for remembering that. Anything else? Yeah, please.
One of my favorite quotes from this movie was, if a foreign country were doing this to our kids,
right,
we'd go to war. Why would we accept this from our own country?
The epidemics of food in this country are the big news. There's no disputing that, and they are food based, and they are, and there's a connection between, you know, our diets and our own personal responsibility. But there's also the question of industries using addictive foods and addictive processed foods to promote sales and make us unhealthy.
It kind of reminds me, I think I saw it in Food Inc. I don't remember where I saw it, but Kraft mac and cheese, they have one mac and cheese for the U.S. and another mac and cheese for Europe.
How funny, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all, yeah, sure.
Don't
higher fat one for the U.S. maybe, I don't know. Yeah, sure, good. Okay, anything else here? Let's see. Oh, there's a lot else here, I just want to kind of, one thing I really focused on in this movie, on this viewing was the WHO report, World Health Organization report up there, 916. Does anybody remember that story? You want to tell that story? Anybody remember that? Yeah.
I think they talked about how the WHO wanted to publish like the daily dietary guidelines, whatever, and the U.S. paid them to remove that sugar recommendation from the document. So when you look on a nutrition facts, it's not going to tell you the daily percentage of sugar that is in that food because it can't be agreed upon.
Right. Good. Good job. I'll add a couple of details. I mean, you got it. That was great. So the consensus among nutritionists in this process, and these are not single studies, these are like groups and they review a lot of literature, was that no more than 10% of your daily calorie intake should be from sugar. The sugar industry got the federal government to threaten the UN with withholding of $400 million in payments, because we pay a lot to the UN, and we can use that as leverage, and the report was quashed, I think you're supposed to say. Squashed is like if you put it in a compactor. And then that also is reflected, as you pointed out, in the fact that when you look at a nutritional label on any package of food, it'll tell you how many grams of sugar, but it won't tell you what percentage of your RDA that is, and because we can't agree on that, because the nutritionists agree on it, but the industry doesn't agree with the nutritionists. So that's a good, really good specific example of ideology in the food, in our food culture, because it's a place where we have reliable, consensual knowledge from experts, and we can't teach it to people because it's politically unpalatable. No pun intended. Okay? All right. Let's look at Cowspiracy. As I said, I have an affection for this movie, but we do need to bring up some pretty big criticisms of it. So let's start with the positive. I think the movie is substantially correct in its main thesis, which is that modern-day meat and dairy production consumption levels are unsustainable with globally in relation to climate change. Could this group, could you guys say a little bit about some of the specific evidence that was cited for that? How do you unpack this thesis, just for the people who didn't see that movie?
I guess like the water usage with producing, you know, how many pounds of hamburger meat or how much.
Why does it use a lot of water to produce meat?
Cows.
That's kind of, it's like all the footprint of the whole thing is like cows drink so much, or it costs to grow the food that cows eat. It takes
right,
so many
you gotta start
of
there.
Water, right, and then you know they like take in so much water, and then. Mm-hmm. This whole water footprint is like basically what it came down to is that one hamburger takes in, has like a footprint of 600 and...
Quarter pound hamburger, yeah. A pound of hamburger meat is about
plus,
2,500
yeah.
gallons, was it?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's insane. But that's a little deceptive. I don't want to get into the criticism right away, but yeah, we'll do the criticism later. Yeah, but that's substantially true. Meat requires huge inputs, oil inputs, water inputs, and it has huge outputs. It's part of the contributor to dead zones and oceans. It's definitely a contributor to, you know, if you ever wondered how you could get E. coli from spinach, it's because the effluent from the large feedlots runs off into the vegetable crops. And so you can actually get E. coli on your spinach because of that. I mean, it's really horrible. We are subsidizing every hamburger. This was the movie that compared the price, the real price. So one of the themes of this movie was that You need this term in your notes, is that there are costs that are not in the food. So these are called, economists call these externalities, right? When you impose a cost on society, like by polluting, but that cost isn't recouped in the product that you sell. So externalities in Cowspiracy are mostly environmental. Externalities in Fed Up are mostly health-related, right? Because huge amounts of disease that we're paying for, but that you don't pay for that when you buy the hamburger. So that's an interesting comparison to make. Are you paying the cost, or is the federal government, both Food Inc. and Cowspiracy, make the point that the federal government subsidizes the cost of beef by subsidizing corn in addition to subsidizing beef production? So, yeah, good. Let's see. What else stood out to you guys from this one? Oh, I should say this movie is largely based on the UN FAO report, maybe some of you are familiar with, called Livestock's Long Shadow. Has anybody heard of that before? Maybe in environmental philosophy class you would. There are some criticisms of this report. Now, this is not a criticism of the movie. The report, for instance, includes impacts on climate change from deforestation, which is legitimate in the sense that there's deforestation occurring to grow cattle so that people can eat more meat. But some people would say what you need to do is ask what would the environmental impact be of a moderate meat consumption. And this movie doesn't go that way because it wants to build the case for veganism. There are noble reasons to consider a vegan diet. It's not my calling, but I think it's a very respectable diet. I think it's the dietary equivalent of biking to work and doing without a car. You know, I think it's people who are conscientious vegans and take care of their diets are doing a lot of good for us. They're sending really good examples. I don't think you have to be a vegan to eat sustainably, but you certainly can't eat 4 pounds of meat a week. That's our average in this country, 200 pounds a year. And for health reasons, I think I've already pointed out, you shouldn't eat more than a pound a week. But when it gets down to how much meat we can actually sustainably have, you know, I don't think there's an authoritative estimate of that, but it's certainly not more than a pound a week. So you see what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, they were talking to one guy, and he's asking him, well, how much do you have to intake for it to be sustainable? And I think he said 2 ounces.
Yeah, pollen. That was Michael Pollan. Yeah, he was saying, maybe a few ounces. Yeah.
Right.
And a lot of, well, I don't want to go into all that. No, yeah, please.
They also, like, touched on it a little bit when they talked about people who, like, try and, like, validate their eating habits by going, like, meatless Monday.
Right.
Well, then you're, like, living sustainably for the environment 6 out of the 7 days
a week. Yeah, that was a good comment that guy made. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really an open question in my mind. So sustainability is an interesting thing. The FAO report was partly criticized because it took a global totals approach to sustainability. And so when you throw in the water, you throw in all these other externalities. But I don't want to get into a big digression on this, but, you know, Brian Henning and I have had long conversations about this. Because he likes the FAO analysis, because he's really focused on climate change, which is great. You know, he really teaches a lot about that. But here's the point in detail. An organic grass-fed ranch outside Spokane, which is close to a mountain water supply, is not really consuming water in the same sense as an industrial feedlot in the Midwest. Because the water sources, water moves, right? And you don't like use it up. Water goes into a cycle. So in an ecology where there's plenty of water and it's easy to grow grass, the sustainability equation is a different analysis. Does that make sense? Rather than just say adding up global totals as if this is all stuff that's just going to be consumed and used up and never come back again. Well, the water is not like that, you know. Plants are not like that. Soil is not like that. In Cowspiracy, it made it, you know, we'll get into the logic problem later, but, yeah.
Something I thought that was interesting that they kept referring to in the movie was I think it was 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions are from the production of dairy and meat. But do you know, like, the FAO's report, was it, like, they were the grave on their analysis of all that? I'm just, like, curious
good.
How that
Yeah, good. That's one of the issues in the movie. The movie's been rightly criticized for always going to this number, But if you were looking for a consensus of experts, it would be more, I think, more in the 30%. But that's still pretty interesting. That's still twice the impact of the transit sector. So when the movie says we could keep driving our cars if we didn't have this kind of impact from agriculture, I think there's a point to be made there. Especially, now let's bring out what's the main method in the movie, right? Kip Anderson is this Socratic guy, right? He's going to go to these environmentalists, and what does he do? What does he ask them?
Well, he always asks them if they know about this statistic.
Yeah.
And it's like, Maddie said, he always brings up the 51%, but something that we were talking about that's interesting is that everybody acts like they don't know, which we said some of them genuinely seem like they don't know.
A lot of them didn't know, I think.
And I don't know, that's just kind of surprising in the sense that it can be, it's so much larger of a consumer or producer of greenhouse gases, but yet we have so much focus, all the agencies
right.
basically only focus on transportation and
fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it is scandalous. This is what Socrates did. I mean, he went to people in authority and he showed that they didn't have the knowledge they pretended to have. And so these environmental organizations, National Resource Defense Council, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, they are membership organizations. And what the movie claims, which I find credible, is that it's not compatible with their business model to tell their members to stop eating meat or even to reduce meat. I mean, you just won't join again. People want to be environmentalists without changing without changing their food lifestyle.
Did the movie touch on at all, like, how much meat is wasted, like, from grocery stores because it went bad?
Food waste is huge. There are some estimates that food waste is 35 to 40%. I think when you guys think about your own diets, it's really good for you to think about food waste. How do you use food? How much gets thrown out? That's a really good issue to bring up. Okay, a few more details here. So the method in the film is he goes around and interviews these people, but then the film starts to go off the rails at the end. I'll just make this criticism, and I just want to point out the logic problem here, because basically what he does is he's moving toward the claim that the only sustainable healthy diet is a vegan diet, and I don't think that's true. I wouldn't argue for that. I think he's absolutely right that vegans are giving us the most sustainable example of a diet. It is a healthy diet. You can do it and be healthy. But that doesn't mean it's the only healthy and sustainable diet. So what the logic problem is that, and so there are better ways to defend veganism, and we'll get into that. The argument pattern that's problematic is, he kind of goes through all these different foods and says, well, if beef, dairy, fish can't feed the world sustainably, then we shouldn't eat any of it. And that's ridiculous, right? You go back and watch the movie. He basically kind of goes through this analysis. Well, can we, he goes to the dairy guy. And says, well, can we feed the world with dairy? And the guy says, no. And says, well, can't eat any dairy. And he goes to the beef, the fish people, and the Oceana group. And, well, can we feed the world with fish? Nope, not enough fish. Well, we can't eat any fish. Crazy. I mean, I like Kip Anderson. I think he's substantially right in this movie that we should be paying, that we have an ideological moment that he's uncovering in the culture that we can't bring ourselves to see that a huge part, maybe twice the transit sector, a huge part of the impact on global climate change is from the way we're eating, the way we're feeding ourselves. So I think he's substantially right. I think the movie kind of goes wrong at the end, but it's still substantially correct to say that we aren't facing the connection between food and environment, right? Okay. Other things to add in here? There's the public land management story. We'll run into that again. Some people advocate something called rewilding, which is to kind of repopulate, to reverse the encroachment of agriculture on wildlife by reintroducing wide range of animals into ecosystems that can support them. But what we do is the opposite. We pay taxes so that the federal government will slaughter tens of thousands of animals that are endangering animal grazing on public land, which is also subsidized. So we're paying to kill the wild animals on public lands because we're giving animal ranchers a subsidized deal to feed their animals on those lands. You see that? There's two things happening that are reasonably objectionable. In a market economy, why would the federal government be subsidizing ranchers, right? Why would they be subsidizing corn? That the market's supposed to do that. But we have this history of, you know, it was only in the early 20th century that we did have nutritional illnesses from undernutrition. And it's important to realize, I mean, we're a rich country, but in the early 1900s, we had people who were undernourished. So that we'll get into the Nestle article on that. But other things from Cowspiracy? Criticisms, things that you found interesting?
Do you want to talk about the targeting of activists?
Oh, yeah, that was a very powerful story. Yeah,
yeah.
Go ahead, bring that up.
So basically, they did a lot of rainforest deforestation in order to substitute it with cattle farms. And that led to a lot of, like, especially in Brazil, a lot of activists speaking out about that, but then they would get murdered.
Yeah, a very powerful story about a Catholic nun who was advocating for indigenous people who were being displaced by this process. She was killed, and then I think in 20 years, maybe over 1,000 activists have been killed. We're all paying for the burgers, and in a lot of different ways.
I was curious to know, though, if, because it said it was when they displayed her like that and everything, it was from the food industry that, like,
I don't know. See, that's
it was just, like, stated as a fact, like, the
that's,
food industry
yeah,
targeted
yeah,
her.
Yeah, good,
and, like,
good, good skeptical eye. Good, yeah. No, I really want you guys to be good critics. That's what, you know, what good philosophers do. I would have wanted to follow up on that, too. That's a good thing to catch. What?
It's quite a claim.
Yeah, it is quite a claim. Do we know that? I had the same thought.
It was
thought.
Really
yeah,
passive,
good.
Too. It was just, like, that is who
yeah,
did it. And then it was
yeah,
the next scene.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Yeah, documentary movies like this, you know, you have to be skeptical of them. But yeah, so that's one, that's an occasion to drill down. Maybe that would be an interesting thing to Google. Maybe there is evidence of that. Okay, so let's get back together. If we could move our chairs back into rows, we'll do some work on the Nestle article, and then we'll be in just a bit. I forgot to mention this concept in connection with Food Inc. It's really kind of arises more than that. If you could take some notes, I think that we have a few things to jot down about this. Regulatory capture is a really interesting concept. It's a theory that actually was created by a famous UW economist back in the 80s, I think. I'm blanking out on his name. And regulatory capture is the theory that private corporations will sometimes find it in their self-interest to control regulatory processes. And so in Food Inc., when you saw all of the revolving door stories about food industry executives going into government, and when you hear stories about how we can't print the RDA on sugar because it's too politically viable, that would be evidence of regulatory capture. Because that would be a case where there's clearly a public interest that experts would recognize. We have an interest in knowing how much sugar we should eat each day. But there's an industry that's captured the regulatory process politically. So regulatory capture captures that idea. Does that make sense? And I wanted to make sure that term is in our vocabulary. All right. Let's go ahead and take out the Nestle article or bring it up on a screen if you can. And take a minute and turn page through it.
It's okay. Bring it up on our phones.
Absolutely. Phone's fine, whatever. You know, this is good to be, it whatever works for you. I still encourage you to print. I know some of you are probably too good an environmentalist to print your stuff, but you can recycle it.
It's kind of
maybe you could print on edible paper. You just eat it later. Okay? All right.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah, right. Yeah, somebody should invent edible paper, don't you?
Patent.
Because I know there's edible plates they make out of corn.
Do they really?
They're white
know.
Plates.
Like edible
yeah.
utensils.
They make it thin enough.
Yeah. All right, so Nestle is one of the most authoritative nutritionists in the country. She had this powerful experience helping edit the Surgeon General's report. She tells about that experience. Does anybody remember the story about why we don't produce that report anymore? Surgeon General used to be, Surgeon General is outside the Department of Agriculture, so he or she, I don't know if we've had a woman do it, has often had more independence. It's usually a medical expert, it's usually a doctor, highly respected physician. Anybody know that story? Why don't we produce the Surgeon General's report on diet and nutrition anymore? We stopped in 2000. Does that ring a bell for anybody?
Mm-hmm. Was,
it's okay, I'll do it. I know. So she says the reason is because we would have had to tell people to eat less. And that was politically unpalatable. So that's her claim. And she'd worked on it. She said, we finally got to the point where we couldn't just tell people to eat more of other foods because the problem was that people were eating too much of foods that are protected by the food industry. And so if you want a more up-to-date detail on that, you could get an example from this NPR story about how the new type, the 2015, we don't produce the Surgeon General's report anymore, but we still produce the food pyramid, the dietary guidelines, although the pyramid, we're going to read about the pyramid. It's got problems. But the new dietary guidelines came out in 2015, and you get in that story, you learn that the meat industry was successful in suppressing advice to eat less meat. And clearly, there's a consensus document that came out of the UN last year, which is where I get this figure of eat no more than 1 pound a week. No processed, no cured meats, no sausage. Sorry to ruin your fun here. And above 1 pound a week, you start to incur health risks. So I take that to mean you can actually have a healthy diet that does include some meat. And if a pound a week isn't enough for you, that's a fair amount of meat. And one reason I'd encourage you to think about what you're actually eating while you're taking this course is that would be a benchmark that I'd regard as authoritative. It's from a huge study that came out, as I said, last year, to go maybe a little bit into 2015. Okay, so that was kind of her professional experience and background. But what she's real, the thesis that you should record in your notes here is really here, that she, like many nutritionists today, would say that our problems have to do with the industry imperative to encourage people to eat more. And the argument is that these are industries that are publicly traded corporations, their investors expect returns on their investment. So it gets at that question of whether the food industry whether there's a mismatch between our intuitions to help corporations grow and contribute to a healthy economy and the food case in which that growth seems to lead to health problems. And so that's a really interesting business and society issue, isn't it? Like even if you're like me and you're generally supportive of free enterprise and you think generally it's good for people to have the freedom to set up businesses and grow them and employ people, I think that's all pretty good. I don't have any problem with that. Even if you believe that, you might ask yourself, is there a problem with this industry because its growth will come at the expense of people's health? Because the only way to keep these businesses growing is for us to eat more every year, right? So that's a huge problem. And it's part of the ideology that we as a country face in reforming our food system. We have deep commitments to free enterprise, which, as I said, I don't have any problem with. Now, in this article at page 5, you get the first example in the course of a very concise statement of what nutritionists generally agree is a healthy diet. If you could flip to that page, let's just look at it together. And you can tell, she stated, it's what is a healthy diet, right?
Pages,
It's page 5, sorry. And there's a lot of detail there, but the bottom line at the end of that second paragraph on the next page is that a large proportion of your calories should come from plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, and grains. And we're gonna be unpacking that, but that in a nutshell, in those two paragraphs, and you can even include the third, is really what I would mark in your notes as a consensus position among nutritionists, that a healthy diet can include a wide variety of foods, but they have to be balanced, and a large proportion of your calories should come from whole foods, real foods. And that's a message you're going to get in Michael Pollan's book, In Defense of Food. Eat food, by which he means real food. Eat less, by which he means eat less. And eat mostly plants. And that's the same consensus position you're getting right here. So I just want to tag that. I mean, we're going to learn a lot more about nutrition in the course. But I think that is a starting point that I would say is pretty non-controversial. So what she does in the rest of the article, in the central part of the article that I found important, was she gives you some really authoritative facts, some of which you heard in some of these movies, but this is a document that we've all got now because we all read this one. And so I want you to be able to access, make a note here, you know, that you can get access to some of the big facts about food-related, dietary-related illnesses and trends. Trends in our eating. You learn about the low variety of food in our diets. You learn about this concept of nutrition transition. Can we gloss that real quick? I was going to ask you a quiz question on this, and I thought, well, this is a little too detailed. But it comes up two or three times in the chapter. Nutrition transition is the phenomenon which rich countries experience of transitioning from food insecurity, under eating, to overeating. So what you observe in almost every rich country, the Europeans are catching up with our gluttony. What you observe in every rich country is a transition toward overconsumption of foods that lead to food-related illnesses, like diabetes, coronary heart disease, cancers. And that epidemiology is not in doubt. That is not controversial. If you deny that connection, it's like denying climate change. I mean, we just have to go back to square one. The analysis, what we should do, who's responsible, that's all up for grabs, right? Okay. Other things from this piece that stood out to you? I thought it was interesting to learn that we spend only 10% of our income on food, as I mentioned at the beginning. We'll talk more about that. Some people argue that that's evidence. Oh, there's a link on the wiki with more comparative data with different countries. Some people argue that that's part of our problem, is that we don't savor food. And in the gastronomy section of the course, which we'll sample next week, and then we'll do later in the semester, there's a really interesting discussion to be had about our food enjoyment culture, whether one part of our problem is that we don't savor food, so we don't treat it as important enough to want really good food. We still want cheap calories. That's what's puzzling about nutrition transition as a phenomena. Why would rich countries continue to want to produce cheap calories? We're rich enough now that we should want to produce better calories, better quality calories, which will be more expensive, but instead we go the other way. And as we'll learn, some of the problems caused by this are visited disproportionately on poor people in this country. So it's not clear that people are being helped by being given cheap calories that make them sick and dependent on expensive medication. Okay, let's break there. I'll see you on Thursday, and